agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politic Guys, the place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School. Welcome back to the show, Ken.
Oh, it's great to be back.
It's always a lot of fun to be here. I have to say, it's particularly fun for me to be here because I'm not, you know, like recovering or in death's doorstep. I think the first thing that we're going to kick off with, Ken, is we're going to take a look and talk about Biden's trip to Europe this week. But before we do that, we're going to actually have a quick pause for an ad, and then we come back. We're going to tackle Biden's visit to Europe. So, Ken, on Wednesday, Biden headed to Europe and kicked off a series of meetings, and this isn't going to be just something we can talk about this week. It's definitely going to be bleeding into next week, maybe in bigger part next week, because next week Biden is headed to Russia, and I think his meeting with Vladimir Putin is going to be a big issue. But of course, this week the note was his meeting in the United Kingdom and his attempt to kind of restore that special relationship with the UK. With Boris Johnson, which is probably a little bit uneasy in this, in the sense that we've had the recent with Brexit, whereas there might have been a little bit more commonality with Trump. And I think most of the trip has really been overshadowed in the United States by kind of that inside baseball take, arguing that this is a terrible time for a trip, given the state of Biden's domestic policy. Now, I know that we want to break down the domestic policy in a minute, but what do you think about actual visit, and will it be able to have any kind of meaningful traction moving forward, given the spin that we're seeing on it in the United States? And in part, as a presidential scholar, it's a little surprising. Oftentimes, presidents get a little bit additional coverage and power when they go overseas, in part because presidents have more visibility and direct command in that role of international relations. But in this case, it doesn't seem that that's playing out for Biden. So I'm just kind of curious, is there much to be gained here, or is it all going to be subsumed, domestically speaking, by what's happening in the Senate?
Well, I would sort of break that into pieces. You know, the criticism that you're talking about is primarily, you know, partisan criticism that I think in today's environment, it doesn't really matter what Biden does. Any day of the week, whatever he does, he's going to be subject to a lot of partisan criticism. In terms of whether it's actually a good time to go. Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect time to go. For one thing, the G7 is actually meeting, so he should go there to go to the G7 meeting. For another thing, he's literally not needed in Washington. You know, there's complete gridlock right now in the Senate. There's nothing happening legislatively. He rightly decided that it was time to pull the plug on the charade of infrastructure negotiations. You know, what could he possibly be needed for in Washington right now? There's no better place for him to be than overseas. And finally, in terms of what he could actually accomplish, you know, I don't know how much he could actually accomplish at these meetings, but I don't think that's so much because of the domestic situation as because of the legacy of Trump, which is mainly that our foreign partners, you know, I think so much trust was shattered with them that there's limits to how much trust they would place in the U.S. or how much leadership the U.S. could exercise. And I think that is exacerbated probably by the fact that Biden, in common with Trump, has as one of his main foreign policy goals to try to generate more of a coalition against China. And I think that that's not something that Europe is especially interested in. So that certainly does pose a challenge in terms of getting things done.
Well, you know, I recognize that there has been partisan barbs at Biden. But the thing that struck me, that I guess my question really more from, was when I looked at all of the major newspapers that I read on a regular basis, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. There were zero newspapers that did not put his visit completely in terms of what's happening on the domestic side. And I guess that's part of what surprised me, in that, again, oftentimes presidents get a little bit more press. And so in this case, I'm thinking actual press, not just the kind of the barbing, partisanship that we're talking about here, but the actual press. I mean, that was clearly the frame. And I guess I was, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised by that, but it did a little bit surprise me, given that presidents often get a little bit more latitude, that there weren't those kinds of conversations that you were putting forward. Did that part of it surprise you? So kind of putting aside the partisan, but just, you know, the lack of any kind of positive press even got. Again, even the New York Times, what is it? What's the shaping narrative is he's leaving during a domestic time. And that, matter of fact, that's what his press secretary responded to journalists.
Well, I'm actually, when you said that, I just pulled up the New York Times' webpage, so I have it in front of me now. And the two main page one headlines both do concern his trip to Europe, but neither one of them mentions domestic politics. So the first headline, which is actually I was kind of relying on a little bit in what I said a few minutes ago, is America may be back in Europe, but how much has really changed? And it's mainly focusing on the challenges he's having there, given the change attitudes about the United States that arose during the past 4 years. But it doesn't mention a single thing about domestic politics here. And then the other secondary headline says G7 leaders will pledge to donate 1 billion COVID vaccine doses. Here's the latest on their meeting. So I think that the news reporting that's actually coming out of the meetings in Europe is reporting what's actually happening in Europe. There was a lot of reporting yesterday about the new Atlantic Charter that he signed with Boris Johnson in the UK. So I think some things are getting done, and I don't really see that there's a downside to being in Europe now relative to being in America now. I let me throw that back at you. What do you think he should be doing in America if he was in America right now instead of in Europe?
Now, in this case, I don't honestly think there's much that President Biden can do the U.S. I think that often there is over-reliance of expectation on what presidents can achieve. As a matter of fact, I think that's one of the reasons that we have more oftentimes dangerous presidential actions is an attempt to meet expectations that can't be met by presidents. We want things to happen rapidly. We want them to happen now. And that's how we end up judging presidents. And yet that's not generally what presidents can or ought to do. So in this case, I wouldn't actually disagree with your underlying assessment. And so my raising that point was not not intended as a critique on Biden so much as a thinking about how perhaps Biden is not necessarily getting the same kind of boost that you would traditionally expect in kind of that aspect. So it wasn't actually a critique on the Biden.
Okay, I see. Yeah, just on the U.S. politics, then all I would say about that is it's hard to get big boosts on anything right now because the public is very polarized. But his favorability ratings do remain very high. And, you know, they may not have gone up very much because he's in Europe compared to where they were a week ago. But he's hovering around 60% favorability in a country that's pretty 50-50 in terms of its politics. So I certainly don't think this is hurting him politically.
No. And the other thing, as I wonder, is about, I mean, well, let's put it this way. I mean, one of the things I'm curious to see is that internationally, we in the United States have had, and you would put it right, this is a time where maybe trying to repair some bridges that we've had, especially with Western Europe. And I one of the reasons for bringing up Biden's meeting with Vladimir Putin for next week was I believe that what's happening right now is primarily kind of a buildup to repairing those relationships for having a different kind of talk with Russia than we would have seen with Trump. And so I'd love for you to talk into that a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think it's complex because, You know, I think that with Russia, some of the Western European allies, particularly Germany, are not at all interested in any kind of new Cold War with Russia. And so I don't think it's going to be that easy for Biden to push them into starting anything like that. And in fact, it doesn't seem to me like that's actually his strategy. I think it seems to me like his strategy towards Russia is to kind of ignore Russia, try to marginalize Russia, try to kind of treat Russia as a very second rate power that doesn't merit significant attention, but not to elevate it by really trying to round up our allies to do all kinds of things against it. And I think that's a realistic way to do things, given the situation with Europe. And also, I don't think, you know, even though I think Biden personally is going to be successful at some bridge building, and he's certainly, it's like it's a relief to every head of European government that Biden's in and Trump's out. But nonetheless, the fact that, you know, Trump was president for 4 years, that Trump or someone like him could possibly be elected again in 2024, that the U.S. doesn't seem to have even been able to unify enough to even do something about the January 6th insurrection. I think all of these things contribute to really outweigh the relief that Europeans will feel that Biden is in office and make them feel like they need to chart a more independent course. They can't go back to that American century of just being reliant on American leadership for everything. America has become too unreliable. And so I think they're happy that he's in, and they're hoping that they can work with him. But I don't think they're just going to follow American leadership on things that aren't in their own interest anymore.
That's kind of a final follow up there. Do you think that kind of the bipartisan anti-China policy that we've seen and the bill that we've seen come out of the House and the Senate is in part kind of hanging over the trip to Europe and what could or could not be done there?
Yeah, he's not going to accomplish that much on China. And I don't know that he's even going to try that hard to accomplish that much on China. The idea that, you know, then this is really one of the areas, Afghanistan being the other, I think, where the Biden foreign policy is the same as the Trump foreign policy. You know, I think the U.S. kind of, you know, really wanted to ratchet up some kind of hostility with China as China both eclipses the U.S. as being the most important country in the world, and also, you know, does some things that are somewhat threatening to U.S. interests. I think that's more of an issue for the United States than for Europe. And I think, you know, Europe is, you know, they're not the most important country in the world, so they're not as caught up in the competition about whether it's going to be the U.S. or whether it's going to be America. They get along a little better with
China. You mean the U.S., China?
U.S. or China.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, that you know, the U.S. doesn't want to lose its world primacy to China. But that's more of an issue for the U.S. than for Europe. Europe doesn't have that primacy anyhow. Europe wants to, you know, trade with China, and they do trade a lot with China. I just think that they don't want to get swept up in any kind of new Cold War. And I think Biden's realistic enough about that, that he isn't really going to press very hard. I think this is more like kind of a this visit on that is more about just trying to have conversations with Europe and see what kinds of measures they might be open to going forward. But I don't think he's going to come back with any kind of actual accomplishments on China.
Well, why don't we pause here just for a minute? Because what I want to do, Ken, is to move to the domestic side and specifically talk a little bit about the ending of the infrastructure talks. And as a matter of fact, Thursday's last minute 10-senator bipartisan proposal. But before we do that, we're going to have a brief break. And when we come back, Ken, we'll take a look at the infrastructure deal. So Ken, the infrastructure deal has gone through something this week. So before leaving for Europe, Biden ended talks with Senator Shelley Capital, the West Virginia senator and the primary Republican negotiator. And then also this week, Manchin dropped a couple of bombs. One, he openly stated that he opposed changing any kind of filibuster rules. And then secondly, in a big editorial, said he was against the For the People Act. Now, that's just struck some people as a bit ironic since he had actually co-sponsored a 2019 version of the bill. But nevertheless, this didn't look good for Democrats' ability to get things done. Now, some things have happened. Congress, of course, passed the American Jobs Plan, for example. And then again, late Thursday evening, a group of 10 Republican and Democratic senators pushed forward a compromise $1 trillion infrastructure bill. So, Ken, what do you think? Let's just start by saying, where do you see the state of the domestic Biden plan? And then I have some specific questions and thoughts as we kind of think about Manchin.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say all of the developments of the past week or two don't fundamentally change the analysis that you and I talked about 3 or 4 weeks ago. In my mind, mm-hmm. I think that there's these two tracks where Biden is hoping, and certainly Manchin is forcing his hand on this hope, that as much as possible can be passed on a bipartisan basis. And even before, even a month ago, there were a handful of chunks of this that were already passed on a bipartisan basis, like the water infrastructure component of it was already passed on a bipartisan basis. So I think to the extent that anything can be passed on a bipartisan basis, that's being pursued. But Schumer has continued to say consistently, and he did say it again yesterday, that the Dems are proceeding on two tracks and that there's going to be bipartisan components of it. And there's going to be a component of it that's done on reconciliation on a partisan basis. And I tend to think that although this week looked like kind of a setback for the Biden administration, I think that's illusory. I think, you know, pretty much we're on track for most of the Biden plan to pass. And I think Manchin, you know, is looking primarily for political cover. I think he's primarily concerned, you know, that in West Virginia, he needs to be seen as someone who is working with Republicans. And to the extent that he can actually, you know, pull together groups, and he must have played a key role in that group of 10 that came together yesterday and get things done on a bipartisan basis, that's going to look very good for him. But ultimately, I do think he's going to give his vote to the Dems on whatever's left over to be done in reconciliation as well on the spending side. Now, probably not on the For the People Act, which you mentioned, but the spending side stuff can all be done on reconciliation. The parliamentarian has already ruled that. So that can be done on a partisan basis without changing the filibuster rule.
Well, as a matter of fact, if we go back 4 weeks, as you had noted, one of the positions that you had took was that you thought that Democrats thought that Biden should take the point of bipartisanship, sense of saying, here's an opportunity to become part of our bill, but we're not going to fundamentally change what we're doing moving forward. Do you still see that as being, so when you talk about Schumer and the ability to get Manchin on board with reconciliation, do you still see that as being the ultimate bipartisanship in that sense, Ken?
Yeah, that's what I think is coming. Now, I'm not saying that the entire $4 trillion bill is going to get through. You know, it could be less, but I think we're going to see $2 to $3 trillion actually coming through, and Manchin voting for all of it. I fundamentally think that's where we are. That all of this is coming, and some parts of it may come through ordinary regular order on a bipartisan basis and get enacted with a filibuster-proof majority, including Republican votes. But I think the majority of the Biden proposals are not going to get enacted that way, but they're going to get enacted anyhow. I think that's all the same as 3 or 4 weeks ago.
So now I want to talk about one particular aspect of the passing, because again, you know, Manchin and increasingly maybe one or two other Democratic senators have kind of taken on that centrist role or that switch role. I know there's a lot of different terms for that. But I know that this kind of breaking with the Democratic agenda, for example, on the For the People Act, has led to a lot of hand-wringing on the left against Manchin and others. And I was curious about your take on something that I have been kind of pondering and thinking about in terms of passing these bills. It seems to me a little bit ironic, the desire for Democrats to want all of the Democrats to completely go along with the singular agenda, because isn't that kind of precisely what Democrats have been railing against on the Republican side of the aisle, effectively? The inability to have any space in the Republican Party means that you have to go along with the craziest crazies who hold things together. And oftentimes they have held up, I think rightfully so, individuals like Romney, who have in some places broken with the party. But in this case, it seems like Manchin is simply kind of getting all of the ire of the Democratic Party for kind of doing precisely the thing that a Republican would get points for. Why do you think that's the case? I mean, for me, it seems like effectively what Dems say, well, is if we're doing it, it must be right, moral, and correct. And if you don't go along, well, then obviously you're the, you know, you're breaking the team. But isn't that the same kind of dangerous thinking that we had in the Republican Party?
I wouldn't look at it that way, although I also don't criticize Manchin for any of this. So let me sort of break that in pieces. First, you know, with Manchin, I'm very happy with Manchin. I'm not angry at him. So my view is that he's a Democrat who's been elected in West Virginia, which is a state that Trump won by nearly 40 points. And he does go along with the Democratic agenda at least half the time, probably more frequently than not. And also because he's there, that's the reason that Chuck Schumer is the majority leader. If Manchin wasn't there, there'd be a Republican in that seat and Mitch McConnell would be the majority leader. So as a Democrat, I feel like I owe a great debt of gratitude to Joe Manchin for actually discovering a politics that allows him to hold on to that seat in West Virginia and have that be a seat that at least often is available to vote with the Dems. So I've got nothing against Joe Manchin. I'm not even sure that all the criticism against him that you've noted isn't something that he courts, right? This may all be somewhat performative, right? It may benefit him in West Virginia to be perceived as the maverick that he is, as the bipartisan guy that he is. And so, you know, when you've got, you know, the Chuck Schumers and the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes of the world, you know, really excoriating him to some extent, that may not be something he's upset by. That may be something he's very much feeling pleased. That may be the purpose of his current position, is to draw that kind of criticism so that he can maintain credibility with a certain cadre of West Virginia voters.
So if I hear you right there, are you suggesting maybe that the others are in on it, or is he just happy about it?
You know, I think Schumer's in on it. I'm not going to go. I don't know. I don't think he consults with AOC, but I think Schumer's in on it. Yeah, I think Schumer. You do see this a lot on the Republican side as well, where I think, you know, this group of five, which doesn't actually include McConnell, the group of five Republican senators who Portman and Murkowski and Collins, Romney, and I can't remember the fifth, maybe Cassidy was the fifth, that just negotiated on the spending bill. Mm-hmm. You know, they only did that because McConnell said that would be fine for them to do that, I'm sure. So even though McConnell doesn't join it and reserves the right to publicly criticize what they've negotiated, you know, he certainly authorized them to go ahead and make those negotiations. So I think there's always some coordination between leadership and loyal members who are going to be trying to take on kind of bipartisan roles. I do definitely think that's coordinated with Schumer. And I think the, you know, in the end, everybody in the Democratic Party benefits, both Schumer and Manchin benefit. If some of these components of this bill can actually be passed on a bipartisan basis, while the rest are nonetheless passed on a partisan basis. Now, in terms of the groupthink thing, which was the other part of your question, Here's where I actually think there's a difference. I don't think that I think it's good for individual members to have their own views and agendas, either because of where they've positioned themselves on the left-right axis within their party cohort, or even just because of unique factors in their states. I think that's fine. You know, if most Democrats are for gun control and Manchin's against gun control because people in West Virginia are against gun control, I think that's good. I think the senators should stick up for the views of their own constituents, which may sometimes differ from that of their party. On these particular issues, and you mentioned this already, not only the For the People Act, but also the infrastructure bill, Manchin's not actually against the substance of anything in these bills. There's nothing in these bills he's against the substance of. So that's a little different, I think. You know, when all these Republicans vote against, say, a January 6th commission, it's not because they're actually against a January 6th commission. It's just because they're supposed to maintain not break ranks, right? They've been instructed to vote that way. And in Manchin's case, you know, I do think the reason I'm confident he'll end up voting, at least for the full infrastructure bill, is that he's basically for it, and his constituents are basically for it, And he's not going to pay a political price in West Virginia for voting to build a lot of infrastructure in West Virginia and to give more money for people who work in elder care in West Virginia and things like that. These are going to be politically beneficial positions for him, and he's certainly going to vote for them. It's just that I think he's going through all these theatrics because people in West Virginia don't want to see him always immediately just doing whatever Schumer says. And so he's asserting some independence in a kind of performative way, I think.
Well, I guess I want to take each of those a little bit because I was genuinely kind of curious about how you'd answer that. Now, on the performance side, I want to start there because I can see and I have thought about that in those terms. Well, do you worry, though? I mean, I worry that the kinds of theater, the kinds of communication that we use in the more contemporary Congress leads to particularly poor outcomes and connections between voters, members of Congress, and the understanding of what actually is happening in Congress. And so I wonder if this idea of needing to have the political theater in this way, does that bother you? And do you see a potential worry there for that kind of theater?
Well, it would bother me more if it always produced gridlock. And I think it does too frequently produce gridlock. But in a case like this where I actually don't believe it's producing gridlock, I truly believe the Biden spending plan is going to get enacted. And not only that, but in terms of the delays, I don't think the delays are actually caused by this public performance. I think the public performance that Manchin and Sinema are kind of engaging in right now is just taking advantage of the opportunity that there's a lot of time. And I know it doesn't feel like there's a lot of time. There's a lot of drum banging on the Democratic side. You know, let's just get this done. We need to move on a partisan basis through reconciliation. We need to get this done. But I think in reality, it takes time, not only because of the politics of it, but because of the legislative process here where, you know, unlike the COVID stimulus bills that were relatively quickly enacted, those bills were simply dumping money into existing programs. But what the Biden plan now is doing is actually creating a lot of new programs, and creating a lot of new programs involves serious legislating. And if they're going to spend, you know, $3 or $4 trillion, a lot of which is going to go into entirely new programs, then those programs have to be thought about. They have to be designed. People have to write down the code. People have to make sure that the code actually says what they're hoping it will say. They have to keep thinking about whether they're doing it right. So even though I think these negotiations are happening only within the Democrats and aren't really bipartisan, I don't think they can be done as quickly as some people think. And Pelosi, even, you know, who probably can get the votes out of the House whenever she wants to, she back in January said sometime around July or August, you know, we'll pass this legislation. And I think that timeline was actually based on the fact that it would be impossible to come in and write this much legislation in less than that much time. So it will really be an unprecedented amount of actual writing of legislative code and thinking through new programs for government. And so I actually think that's the true cause of the delay. And so the looked at in that context, I think if Manchin wants to say, you know, publicly, you know, this whole time, well, you know, the reason I'm slowing things down is that I'm holding out for better and better bipartisanship. I have no problem with that.
I'm going to ask you a little bit of a follow up to that because I had a second part to that, and then we'll have to move on. So we'll have to go quickly. But so when you talk about that, you know, there's kind of the face of it is, well, you have the political theater, but the underlying reason the political theater doesn't bother you is the fact that actual legislating process needs to get done. And it's a slow process, as you point out, right? So you even note Pelosi's comments about how much time that's going to take forward. But by having the theater, don't we actually then take the center stage away from the real process, which is the slow thinking about spending a big bunch of money and on new things point and the effects and the actual effects of what those particular policies and those vehicles for those monies will be, and instead place it on the the meaningless theater, if the analysis here is right, in a way, it's kind of like the song and dance. And so the more of the political theater we have, don't we just take that much more of the important attention away from what we would hope we could slowly educate and move voters towards thinking about more, which would be the actual policies that are being written and worked on? What do you think about that?
No, I think it's a good point in general that you just made, but actually not in this particular case, because in general, I think it would be nice if when the public was following what's going on in Congress, they could actually follow substantive discussions going on in Congress. So I completely agree with your general point. But I think the difficulties right here are that this legislation really is going to be more ambitious than almost any legislation that we've seen in 50 years. And so there's a brainstorming stage. And that's where we still are. And I think it's not, you know, there's that old phrase about, you know, making legislation is like making sausage. You know, you don't want to look too closely at that process. I think we're still at that stage right now where it's not ready for public consumption yet. And public consumption would actually be misleading. Right. If within the Democratic caucus, the insiders are kind of thinking through, you know, what do we really want to have in this bill? And they're thinking of, you know, what could work, what couldn't work, what would the public like, what would the public not like? And they're not at the stage yet where they have something to present. Then I think it's primarily would be a harmful process that would draw, you know, unwarranted criticism of ideas that never were going to make it into the bill anyhow. To present all that too early to the general public. I think we're definitely still in the behind closed doors stage, and that once the legislation is drafted and introduced, that's when there'll be plenty of time for the public input that you're talking about, and it will be beneficial at that stage.
So then I just want to quickly, because I wasn't expecting that follow-up, to ask what was going to be my second question in response to your original answer. And one of the things that you had said there effectively, in the case of Manchin, he's representing his district. He's doing his kind of Mayhewian, Finoian. Fino was the one who argued that you work for your district in that way in the political science scholarship. You know, that's what makes that kind of unique. And then you said, well, when you compare that to, say, Republicans voting against the January 6th commission, where that's obviously just a party line vote. So I want to push on that a little bit, because, I mean, if you take a look, and it doesn't make me happy to be able to say this, but if you take a look at many of states and districts and Republicans' position, it's that they think that that's all a bunch of hooey. So why couldn't it be the case, problematic though it is, that one of the reasons see Republicans voting the way they are is no different than Manchin. That is that they are representing a constituency who thinks that there shouldn't a commission. So how do you bifurcate between those two?
Yeah. I'm sorry. You brought up a different issue I wasn't even thinking about. So so my example wasn't perfect because I wasn't thinking along the lines you just asked, but the difference in my mind, which has nothing to do with anything I said before, is these Republican senators know that they're lying to their own constituents, you know, when they tell them that, you know, so there's a sort of feedback loop between the Trump messaging, which has been picked up by some of the Republican members of Congress, and then the way they end up voting, where, you know, there was an actual attempt by Trump to engage in a violent insurrection and overthrow the electoral count. And these senators know that. But Trump, you know, lies about it publicly, lies about the fact that he lost the election. And these senators then knowingly lie also to support his lies. And then that influences the public opinion that then gets challenged back to them. And then they vote in that way. So I think the reason I criticize that is not because they're voting the way their constituents want them to, but rather because they're playing a role in shaping their constituents' desires by lying to their constituents rather than telling the truth to their constituents. And that's a completely different issue than what I was intending to talk about, which is just that Manchin, I think he's right to go against the Democratic line on gun control, because I think that's not something where he's lying to his constituents or they're lying to him. They have different preferences on gun control than most Democratic constituents have. And so I don't think you're going to see gun control legislation passing despite the horrific spate of shootings recently, because there's not enough Democratic votes to do it, because Manchin, I think, is rightly aligned with his own constituents. But all I'm saying on the spending, and this is all I really meant to say, is that his constituents are actually for the spending. So there's no reason for him not to vote for it.
Okay. Well, you know, sometime maybe we'll have to come back and circle around. I think one of the things that I'm kind of maybe driving at too circuitously is to say that I worry that the kind of political theater that you're positing for, like, the Schumer to Manchin is, while degrees different from the kind of feedback loop of the January 6th insurrection, on that spectrum in a way that worries me, in the sense that as you move forward, it continue to move in that direction. And so that's why I was interested in kind of following back around for that. But I recognize that's a big topic there.
Before we leave it, because I think now I see where you're going, it's a very interesting discussion. I hope we'll fully have this discussion on a different show. But one question I'd ask to you to think about is, let's turn the clock back about 70 years. So Dwight D. Eisenhower wants to build an interstate highway system, and clearly wants to build it primarily for purposes of both the immediate fiscal benefit that the process of building it will give to the country in terms of lots of jobs and things like that, and also for the long-term commercial benefits of having it. But he also is up against all these hawks, mainly in his deficit hawks, mainly in his own party, and tax hawks.
So it becomes
defense.
Don't want to
have that kind of, you know, yeah. So he sells it as being, well, we need this for civil defense. So we can
land planes.
We can land planes. We can move troops quickly around the country. If the Japanese would have succeeded invading the West Coast, we'd want for all the troops in the whole country to have been able to drive quickly to the West Coast and things like that. Now, he knew for every minute of that wasn't the primary purpose of building the interstate highways. And I guess my take on that is, if that's what he needed to do to sell it, and he knew it was in the best interest of the country, that's more or less okay. And that's kind of the way I'm thinking about this Manchin thing. But I wonder what you think about Eisenhower using that rhetorical strategy to get the interstates built.
In all honesty, I have long been uncomfortable, although I recognize the political necessity at times, of the ends justifying the means mechanism. And because, again, what worries me about it is that if we consistently do it repeatedly, in other words, if you think of an institutional system and where we do it over and over again, so I kind of like that you wound the clock back 70 years, right? You know, I don't know if any one of these particularistic instances in and of itself harms something, and you probably get a lot of good out of that particular moment, but does it end up kind of corrupting the system little bits at a time? So, you know, in my thinking, one of the big pieces of the presidential scholarship is the idea that presidents are not just bound by the institutional structure at the outset of anything. As a matter of fact, no institution is, but rather by the precedents that build up over time. And so you have to cumulatively understand and think about those precedents. And little movements in each presidency oftentimes don't have immediate impacts 70 or 80 years ago, but you begin to see potential outcomes of them as they are built upon slowly four-year cycles at a time. So when you talk about something like Eisenhower, I think oftentimes the hope is to be able to say, well, I recognize there was a need. Dwight Eisenhower had to do what he had to do. And so the ends justify the means. But he also creates a presidential precedent. And that presidential precedent is then built upon by future presidents. Presidents don't start from a blank slate. They're starting from that pile of precedents. And I think we oftentimes, because we're just kind of focused on the theater of the moment, we don't ask ourselves the important question, which is, in what small ways am I adding to or detracting from that pile of precedents? And so, again, I kind of like that you roll it back 70 years, because I wonder, okay, you use the ends justify the means for a good purpose, but as we continue to use it for more and more expansive purposes and more often, as that becomes more a part of the arsenal of the presidency to get things done, do we end up with institutional structures that can't contain a Trump? And that is partially my worry. So I hear what you're getting at, but my oftentimes worry is that in isolation, we do things that we actually would not want to see piled up collectively. And then we're shocked when we see the effects of having piled up those small precedents into a larger edifice of precedents, plural.
Yeah. If I say last thing, then I know you want to move on to other topics, but I certainly don't advocate that the ends justify the means as a general rule.
Oh, of course not. I didn't mean to suggest that.
I generally think it doesn't. But in this one kind of particular instance, when we're talking about public political strategies for getting legislation passed, the problem is that some of the best and most impactful and most publicly beneficial legislation is more complex than the general public is really going to put the time or attention into fully understanding. So there has to be some kind of rhetorical strategies, which in some ways at best are going to oversimplify or more commonly are going to somewhat mislead. But I think that those are inevitable incidents of moving big, complex legislation. And so I don't think what Eisenhower did was completely irresponsible. I think it was, a way of getting across, one of the benefits that the interstate highway system would in fact bring. Now it wasn't the primary benefit that was motivating the enactment of the interstate highway system, but we do see troops driving down the interstate highways sometimes. That is something that's mm-hmm. possible because we have it. So I don't think he was lying. I think he was just focusing on something that may have been a minor benefit of a program that was really being adopted for other primary means and selling that. And I think that doesn't rely on saying, well, the ends justify the means, more than saying, I think what I mean to say is that I think that's a permissible and perhaps inevitable means that's not as bad as it might seem, when you're trying to present complex information to the public for, about legislation that actually will benefit the public.
Well, and it's interesting that you put it that way, because in some ways I would agree with part of what you say there when you talk about some of the complexities of the public understanding particularly complex legislation. This is one of the reasons, we've had some space between us before over, matter of fact, a few weeks ago when we were talking about, is it a bug or is it a feature to have not purely democratic elements in a political institution system, right? And we had that conversation the last time we did the show, and although it wasn't the primary point of our conversation, there was some space between us in that you thought there ought to be some additional democracy, and I thought that some of that kind of Republican institutional non-democracy is the feature, not the bug, and we chatted about that, and I think right here you landed precisely on the issue of why having fuller democracy can lead to not desirous outcomes is that you then get into these circumstances where you are having to, in order to get right things done, because you've created a system that is solely popular, you create negative, in other words, you can't get things done because people can't quite understand what it is. I think that, in fact, is genius of a Republican system, which is heavily based on voting and people input, but not completely based on it, precisely so that we can mitigate that kind of need to have the one example being this kind of ends justifying the means, this the inability of the public to understand these kinds of complex things. Maybe they can't in some kind of instances. And so we have institutional systems designed so that they aren't always the only mechanism for that. I mean, would you agree with me a little bit? I'm curious. I'm honestly, that's an honest question.
Yeah, but I think that the I don't see this as a huge space between us, actually, because I do agree with what you just said. The thing is, I would probably distinguish between policy specification and policy implementation here, right? So to me, the general policy that Biden is promoting on spending has bona fide majoritarian democratic legitimacy. Most Americans, and we're seeing numbers as high as 70% now, want to see massive spending on infrastructure right now that will create jobs, that will improve infrastructure. And those numbers stay well into the majority range, even when you do include all the stuff like counting elder care as infrastructure and things like that. So I think the people can understand, you know, do we want the government spending money on this? Do we want the government raising taxes on corporations? Do we want the taxes raising, we want the government raising tax on people who make over 400,000? Those kind of questions the public can understand, and I'd like to see the government more responsive to public preferences. Now, the implementation questions of, you know, what kind of programs do you need to create to actually spend trillions of dollars, and, you know, how should that money be allocated? That's where I think you're getting beyond the ability of the public to, you know, have meaningful supervision over how government goes about doing that. So I would like to see government, you know, more responsive to the general preferences of the public, which I think is really what we talked about a few weeks ago. And not have built-in structures that can create permanent minority rule. But on the other hand, I don't think, you know, every level of implementation that it would be realistic in the nature of things to think about how responsive could that be to public opinion.
Well, that actually is a perfect transition for talking a little bit about thinking about a little on inflation and what the public actually knows. But before we get to that, Ken, we're going to take a brief break. We're going to come back. We're going to kind of investigate what you're talking about a little bit closer and talk a little bit about reports of inflation this week.
Everyone deserves nice things, but with all the markups in traditional luxury retail, high-quality goods can be awfully expensive. Quince is different. They're a one-stop shop for essential products with low design costs. They've got tees, hoodies, loungewear, pants and shorts, blouses, dresses, skirts. I mean, unless you're a nudist, they've got something for you. And you know, even if you are clothing optional, they've got home accessories, bedding, bath, decor, all sorts of good stuff. Quince finds the best factories and only partners with those committed to the highest production standards, fair wages, safety, and sustainability, which is particularly a big deal to me. And because Quince is shipping directly to you with no agents, stores, or other middlemen, you get great 100% factory direct prices on everything. I mean, I've been desperately in need of some new t-shirts, and I was really impressed by the price and quality of their organic Pima cotton selection. And my bath towels, honestly, are looking pretty ratty too. So Quince's great prices on high-quality Turkish bath towels, they really caught my eye. Quality shouldn't be a luxury. You deserve it. So try Quince today. Get free shipping and 365-day free returns by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. Many of their collections sell out immediately, so don't wait. You can save hundreds of dollars on clothing and accessories by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. That's onequince.com/politicsguys.
So, Ken, we want to get back. You, before the break, you had kind of, I think, a really great segue. You didn't realize at the time, maybe, but yeah, I think you had this really wonderful segue where you're talking about most people understand and know that they want spending and that the actual space between is over what ought to be spent on. I'm not sure that I entirely agree. So let me kind of set that up, though. One of the other big stories this week was, and this is something that we had talked about a couple, 4 weeks ago, inflation is ticking much higher than had been anticipated. Now, I don't often tout my own predictive abilities, but I will say that we had a couple of shows where I suggested that that was in fact going to be the case and continue to be the case, at least term. And it appears to be. Outlets as wide as NPR, Reuters, and the Wall Street Journal this week have been reporting on it. Part of this, of course, is the pent-up demand combined with not enough things being produced. Oftentimes, this all heads back to computer chips. Everything from your car needs these chips. But despite Yellen this past week arguing that it might be temporary, the 5% inflationary increase for the 12-month period ending in May was the absolute highest it's been since 2008. And I think there's really absolutely no question that part of this most recent inflation is due to government spending and borrowing. Now, so while the precise magnitude can be difficult to matter, you know, other factors, of course, play in on inflation as well. It's simple economic markets, economics tells us the more of something there is, the lower its value. And in the United States this past year and last year, we printed money at one of the fastest rates ever. We poured more money in the economy than we ever had. So should we really be surprised, I ask, that we see acceleration increase, inflation increase at accelerated rate? As a matter of fact, I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here and say, I think Yellen is wrong. I don't think inflation is going to decrease because I think there's larger underlying factors, just the pent-up demand that are pushing it a little bit higher. And inflation rates will continue to rise. And this kind of gets back into the infrastructure bill. I think if we pour another $4 billion into the economy, this is unprecedented amounts of spending. We're going to see that inflation continuing into 2022 and probably 2023, again, depending on what actually gets passed. So, and it also depends on how much we pay or don't pay for it in taxes, something else that we've talked about in earlier shows. That will then both change and increase inflation and inflationary policies. So here's an example, Ken, where you say a lot of people want spending, and you're not wrong, right? I mean, I'm not going to argue with those, but people also don't want higher prices for their overall goods, and yet these two things go hand in hand. But I don't know if everybody quite always understands that. And so what do you think about, you know, as we've kind of been taking on that question of representation, but at the same time thinking about infrastructure, thinking about inflation, thinking about spending, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, first, you know, I also predicted inflation. So you and I agreed on that prediction. That was, in fact,
it was different rates. That was where we disagreed only. Yes, you're right.
I don't even think we disagreed on that. I thought there'd be high inflation. In fact, I remembered our argument being that you thought our children would have to pay for all this debt. And I actually said our children will never have to pay for all this debt. It'll be paid for in the short run through inflation. So I think we're both on the same page, actually, about inflation. However, I would insist that even if it continues at 5% per year for a while, which would be relatively high, that's well worth it for the kinds of benefits that people are getting. Most Americans right now got more than that as a percentage of their income back just in the stimulus payments that they got the last couple of years. So, you know, if somebody is handed, you know, say more than 5% of their income in cash, and then told that everything's going to cost 5% more now, you know, those people are out ahead. I would also say, you know, I just looked when you mentioned the 5% figure at my own 401k, because some people would say, well, this is really going to be paid for the most by savers, because people who've saved a bunch of money, you know, the value of that money is eroding away. And I noticed that from January 1 to May 31, my rate of return in my 401k was 7.21%. So that's, again, more than the 5%. So the general expansion of the economy that's happened as a result of all this spending, I think, has been good for people, at least for people who've saved in stock retirement funds. And the indications are that real estate is going up as well. So a lot of people who do actually have money saved and invested are not being harmed so much by this inflation. So I definitely think the benefits will outweigh the costs for some time if spending at the current rate continues to provide benefits to people that it has been over the last year, even if inflation continues at 5%. On the other hand, I don't think there's much chance inflation could continue at 5%. And Janet Yellen's very much in the mainstream of economic thinking here when she points out that there's a lot of other factors going on in the last month or two besides a lot of stimulus spending. And the primary thing being that the pandemic is suddenly under control, and there's just tons of pent up demand to spend on all kinds of things. And there's still supply chain problems because of the pandemic. So I think those kinds of issues, which must be contributing to inflation, are very short term. Now, government deficits can also contribute to inflation, but I don't think they're nearly the sole factor going into the current 5% that we're seeing. And the last piece of this is that the Biden plan, of course, does not continue the deficit spending that we've seen over the past year, beginning with the Trump stimuluses. It is more paid for by not fully paid for, but more paid for by tax increases than any of the recent spending has been. And so the tax increases should go quite a ways against increasing the money supply in the way that you've noted has happened over the past year.
Because it's not completely covered. So you're right, it's more covered. But because you're already increasing on a historic amount of debt, it seems unlikely And the reason I'll actually put on this prediction is you talk about Yellen in the mainstream. And in fact, she is. But when you go back to 2008, we had a different arguing that things from that mainstream economic point of view were going to be fine. And once again, it was wrong in part because they hadn't looked at what classical economic scholars look at. So I recognize that the a variant of the mainstream. But the classical guys got it right in 2008, and the mainstream guys got it wrong. So in your answer even there, I hear once again the, well, we need to listen to the mainstream guys who have consistently gotten wrong the market fluctuation effects of spending. And so I think that your call there to say, well, 5% is temporary, despite the fact that we're still going to be, we've already increased. Again, inflation is always a lagged variable. It's predicting the past. So we haven't baked in what would happen. So the idea that you're having less deficit spending on top of already a bunch of deficit spending doesn't, that's somehow going to temper the inflationary policy there. So what do you think about that? Because I was interested in 2008. I was curious about what you'd say about Yellen, because again, it was the classical economists who had that one right.
Yeah, I would not agree with that analysis at all. I think the only problem with the spending in 2009 was that there was only about one third as much of it as there should have been. And that actually caused the recovery to lag for like a decade. If the government would have engaged in anywhere near the level of spending in 2009 that it did engage in 2020 or late 2019 or 2020, that it would have been much, much better for the country. And
better would have been to not have the inflationary housing policies that we did that kind of triggered.
That's completely debunked, Trey. Housing policies have literally nothing to do with the crash. And
even Barack Obama in his autobiography points to that as being one of the factors to that. You can't just throw that to the side.
I'm going to throw that to the side and say it had 0 to do with the crash. And I think the strongest evidence of that is that the crash was identical for lenders to commercial real estate as to lenders to residential real estate. And none of the policies that you're talking about ever applied to commercial real estate.
So you can have that position, but I think that tossing it aside when you have, you know, Obama, or as a matter of fact, you can even take a look at the investigative reporting of like The Big Short, who would agree. Again, we wouldn't agree on everything there, but I don't think you can just quite say, well, that's just all hokey coming from straight from Trey.
Oh, I thought you were talking about policies like the Fair Lending Act and things like that. The Big Short doesn't talk about any of those kind of policies.
No. This is true.
So because I know a lot of right wingers are saying, well, it's because of laws that required banks to not redline neighborhoods and things like that. That was the kind of policies.
I was talking about pumping additional money into the housing market then being surprised by those inflationary effects. And then the coming bubble crash as a result of governmental policies that increased. So that's a smaller example of inflation. So I was trying to use that as a smaller example of inflation. I was not trying to make any kind of those redline arguments. So I apologize if I was not clear about that.
Policies. No, but the failure of the Bush administration to actually enforce bank regulation is what caused that crash in 2008. And the kind of complex derivatives that are written about in The Big Short, for instance, which you raised.
Which allowed for additional inflationary. Continue, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say it allowed for bubbles that would burst in the private sector that threatened to take down the whole financial system, which then left, because the Bush administration never regulated the banks enough to make sure that they weren't taking illegal levels of risk that could bring them down and threaten the whole financial system, then that meant that, when the bubble actually did burst, because these illegal levels of risk had actually been taken without regulators stepping in to stop it, then that gave the government a binary choice, so that towards the very end of Bush's own presidency, he was either going to preside over the complete collapse of the financial system, or he was going to infuse tons of taxpayer money into it. Mm-hmm. And certainly infusing tons of taxpayer money into it was the lesser evil there. I mean, it may have been a little bit inflationary, but the alternative was probably worse than the Great Depression.
No, but so but the example here is that so for example, with the banks are able to pump additional funds into a market that can't actually support it. It leads to inflationary housing prices. Those kinds of weird derivative bets are ways that banks can mask the amount of money that's actually occurring in the housing market. What you're what the analogy here though is that when you pour money, and this is what banks were doing, into a closed system, you temporarily inflate prices and then end up having some kind of disastrous outcomes thereafter. I'm suggesting you're going to see similar kinds of things happen when you have additional money pumped into the economy.
Yeah, I don't think it's comparable to what happened in 2008, because all the problems that happened in 2008 were because of private sector choices. None of them were because of government choices. It's that the government failed to regulate private sector choices, and those private sector financial institutions engage in reckless behavior with other people's money that nearly took down the financial system. It was really a failure of government action, whereas what you're talking about here is just government fiscal policy. And
I would say reckless fiscal policy.
Yeah, you could call it reckless, but it can't cause really the kinds of systemic harms that the banking crisis of 2008 caused. At most, it could cause something like what we're seeing right now, which is unusually high inflation. And, you know, kind of the worst case scenario here is not that the whole system falls apart, but just that inflation continues at 5% a year for a while. But I think there's no
I would say comparatively, though, when you take a look at comparative economic studies, you can't say that the worst case is the 5% and it remains at 5%. Worst case is you see countries that move into much higher levels of inflation, double digits of inflation, extended over periods of 6 months or more, that have profound economic impacts. I think, again, you're kind of minimizing the potential risk.
Well, that would be literally impossible in the United States, because the Federal Reserve System has the ability here to stop that kind of thing. And, you know, when we talked about Yellen before, her comments were made in the context of saying why she isn't at present going to exercise any of the powers that the Fed actually has to raise interest rates or to regulate bank transactions that might rein in inflation, because she's not yet worried about the inflation. Now, if you're talking about 10% levels, we're in a very different context in terms of monetary policy. And of course, the Fed would rein that in, and they have many tools to do so. So that kind of thing is not a serious risk in the United States, I don't think.
Well, why don't we? I think we have some space there, so why don't we move forward to one last, because we're going long. We want to take a look at this past week. You know, of course, we did not get Ken any real 9/11 style investigation into the January 6th insurrection, but on Tuesday, two separate Senate committees released the most comprehensive government report yet on the security issues related to January 6th. Now, the focus in the documents are primarily on the shortcomings of the intelligence community and on its inability to predict the amount of in-life action from online chatter. Now, there were a lot of compromises potentially made, because these were, in fact, bipartisan reports. And in order for the committee to report this, neither of them used the word insurrection, as I have done, for example, nor did it specifically look at any of the relationships to the actions online or off, and then offline to those taken of President Donald Trump at the time. But it did conclude that, quote, January 6, 2021 marked not only an attack on the Capitol building, it marked an attack on democracy, quote. Ains would go on to note that the report did not attempt to look at those origins and the developments of the groups that participated in the cap and the attack on the Capitol, end quote. Those are anonymous aides. Now, the other thing that was, I don't know how much of this of either of the reports that you read, Ken, but in the appendix to both, as I had read pieces of it, rather large chunks of it, the first appendix, as a matter of fact, is Donald Trump's comments, his speech, if you will, prior to the insurrection. And I was, again, just struck by his speech. Time and space has come between us, but kind of having to read through it again, seeing the number of times that he says American elections and the press are neither free nor fair, that we're a third world nation, kind of struck me all anew. So we are not getting a Jan 6 commission, Ken, but what do you think the bipartisan report out of the Senate?
Well, first, I have to confess, I only read the news reporting about the report. I have not had a chance to read the report. So I'll just have to go by how it's been summarized in the news. I think it's unfortunate that the commission that the Senate committee limited its inquiry to really the events of that occurred at the Capitol and to the prior events that in as much as the information received in advance of that day by Capitol Police and et cetera, and did not look at all about the President Trump's role in fomenting all of this. I guess it's going to lead to some immediate improvements in security at the Capitol.
And some communication sharing in a way that was not occurring. Yeah.
So there would be some operational benefits of this. But, you know, in some ways, it's just kind of like, you know, the fastball got thrown and this committee bunted, basically. Right. They just bunted it off and didn't want to dig deep into any of the important issues. That's not surprising. If the Senate committee, if the Senate can't even vote to form a bipartisan January 6th commission, then you wouldn't expect them to, in a bipartisan way, bite off those same issues that they don't want a commission to bite off. So I guess what we're really left with here is that there's going to be partisan committees investigating through the ordinary process. It'll primarily happen in the House, I think. So you'll have House committees where Democrats have working majority on the committees doing the primary investigations of the president's role and of the role of militia groups, I think, which is also significant in the events of January 6th. And we'll also probably wind up seeing a lot of public information developed about these issues in the hundreds of criminal cases. And even though a lot of these criminal cases are probably going to result in plea agreements, certainly some of them are going to be tried and the trials are going to be public and information is going to come out in those. So I don't think this means the public is never going to learn more about the causes of what happened on January 6th, but it is sort of pushing back that point in time when the public's going to learn more.
You know, I don't disagree. It is kind of unfortunate. I was surprised, though, that given that there had to be such a narrow focus, that in the conclusions they are willing to go to the point of saying that it marks an attack on democracy in a couple of different ways. So I was happy about that. And I saw that as being something.
The only thing about that is I guess I see it as being less than something, because it's if you don't say who was behind the attack on democracy, then it does seem to me to be an uncontroversial statement that, you know, literally everybody could agree with, like even people like Senator Hawley or Trump, who continue to say it was really Antifa that was behind all that. You know, they would agree that it was an attack on democracy. So I think without assigning any responsibility, that's a pretty anodyne statement that it would be hard for anyone to disagree with.
Maybe. I mean, I don't hear Trump and some of those using quite that rhetoric, but, you know, you make a valid point there. I was still a little surprised that it found it in. I didn't think that there would quite agreement even to that level. So, but no, your point is fair and valid. The one last thing I'd like to think of, kind of just, I was curious about, you know, reading it again, you know, oftentimes we kind of keep speeches and thing, you know, going to Kennedy's, we're going to go to space, not because it's easy, because we want to do the hard things and the other hard things, you know, or FDR's, we're not going to be afraid of anything but fear. We have these kind of big moments for presidential speeches that kind of live on and live forward and mark moments. And in some ways, I almost want the Trump speech to live on, but in a different kind of way. You know, again, it struck me anew, and I wonder how important it will be to continue to make sure that that is something that doesn't just die, even though it's wrong, you know, not in a celebratory way, but rather in a cautionary tale wet kind of way. What do you think about that a little bit? I that had been rolling in my mind the last few days after having read the report.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you know, there are some notorious speeches that live on in American public memory. I could think of, you know, Governor George Wallace, his speech, you know, segregation True. Now, segregation forever.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, people haven't totally forgotten that. And so maybe this will join that pantheon. I think it will, you know, the very slowness of what's happening in Congress right now in some ways does work towards keeping these issues alive. It doesn't really kill them, right? Because as long as Congress fails to come up with a comprehensive report, fails to come up with a bipartisan committee, it just means that investigations are going to continue in a more random and haphazard and ad hoc type way through criminal cases or through partisan committees. So I think we'll keep hearing about this. Also, you know, it is possible, although I don't really think it'll happen, that Trump will run for president again in 2024. And if he even enters the primaries, then I think that speech that you're talking about is going to appear in a lot of political ads that people are going to see on television, you know, primarily from his opponents, although who knows, maybe he would put him in too and take his benefit.
That's so
I think that at least in near term memory, it'll probably stay alive. And I got to think it's going to make the history books. I mean, it's hard to predict, you know, what people are going to be studying in high schools 50 or 100 years from now. But, you know, we still study the shots that were fired at Fort Sumter, you know, in 1861. And, you know, I mean, this may end up looming as large as that in future studies.
Well, Ken, as always, it's a lot of fun doing the show with you. I hope you had fun, too.
Yeah, of course.
And listeners, I hope you guys have had fun as well. And I just want to thank you for listening to the Politics Guys. I know that Ken and myself, we love doing the show. We wouldn't be doing it otherwise. And one of the ways that this podcast is possible is through the support of listeners like you. One of the ways you can help the show is by subscribing to the Politics Guys on the app of your choice, so to sharing episodes, but also, of course, being a supporter. One of the great things about being a supporter is you're going to get supporters-only content. So, for example, this week, Ken and I did not. There were so many things last week. We cut a number of stuff off. As a matter of fact, just a few things. One of the things that we wanted to talk about was Biden's Department of Justice adopting Trump's liability stance. We're going to be having to do that on the bonus show. So if you'd like to join us for that kind of lost bit, we're going to do that. We're going to be talking about the lawsuit against Arkansas trooper flipping a pregnant woman's car. And then some news, the attorney general in Ken's own hometown of Ohio, and more. We're even head over to Israel. So if you're interested in any of that or any of the amazing things that we do for our supporters only show, every week we have a full length supporters only Wednesday show. And this week, of course, is going to include those items that I've just mentioned and many others. So we also have a supporters only Discord channel. It's a place where you can chat with me or Mike, or now as a result of supporters, just incredible support, Ken. Supporters get access to Discord. So if you want to become a supporter, if you'd like to join us again for our Wednesday show, or if you'd like to be with us online on Discord, all you have to do to check out even more of the benefits of supporting the Politics Guys is check out our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/politicsguys. Or you can go over to politicsguys.com/support. Again, it's patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support. Join myself and Ken again on Wednesday by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you'd like to share with us, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Will Moreno, Andra Masker, Nathan Sosnowski, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. I hope you'll join us next time.